This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ratchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC, News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you for this next hour, where we're going to discuss relevant topics in medicine. And I've been looking forward to today's program, because my guest is going to be Dr. Saeed Ahmed. Dr. Ahmed is the Director of Addiction Services at St. Francis Hospital. And the reason I want to get him on is because there's so much going on with respect to the opioid crisis. Actually, it's become an opioid epidemic right now in terms of the numbers of deaths. The numbers of drug-related overdose deaths in 2021 has been tremendous. 107,000 deaths from overdose. To put that in perspective, suicide from all causes was 48,000 deaths. Traffic accidents were 45,000 deaths. So imagine if you took all the deaths combined from suicide and traffic accidents, drug-related overdose superseded those. And a lot is due to opioids. So I want to get Dr. Ahmed on because there have been a lot of different approaches to the way we look at this problem, right? Everybody remembers the war on drugs, right? I think that might have been back in the Reagan days. I'm not sure, but it was back there. And I don't know if the war is over and we've raised the white flag, but now we have gone to harm reduction. And when you get down to it, that's a good way of looking at it, because all we want to do is keep people alive. So we're always hearing about the availability of naloxone. Now it should be available free to people, and just making it available, naloxone being a nasal spray or an injection that you use to counteract the effects of an opioid overdose. So it's all very confusing for all of us. So I'm looking forward to Dr. Ahmed coming on and spending some time with us. It's going to be an extended interview. He's going to be on at about 11:20, and we're going to go right to the top of the hour. So if you have questions, email them over to me now at info@alessimd.com. And I will bring those questions up to Dr. Ahmed so we can have a lively discussion. This day in medicine, September 16, 1796, Dr. Jean-Baptiste Brouillard was born. He was a French physician. He was actually a neurologist and a medical researcher. And he was the person that first isolated speech to the dominant hemisphere and in the anterior motor pathway. So when we think of speech, right, and we've had a discussion of this before, when we think of speech, there's the motor component where you're actually speaking, and there's a receptive component where you understand what words mean and their relevance. So he was the first to isolate really that there is a speech center that was later identified in 1861 by Dr. Broca, and it took the name of the Broca's area. The receptive type of speech was further evaluated by Dr. Wernicke, and it's naturally named the Wernicke's region. We've gone to using a different dichotomy, a different nomenclature that's a little more descriptive. So we have non-fluent aphasia, which is where someone cannot speak but can understand words. And then we have fluent aphasia, where people can speak but they don't understand what the words mean. And we see these often with people who have had stroke or some type of a brain tumor will develop these aphasias. And then there's global aphasia, which affects both components, usually in a very large, devastating event. So anyhow, we remember Dr. Bouillard, who was born this day in 1796. Little update on the COVID boosters. So the first thing, it has been approved now. And we had Dr. Banik on, and he explained to us very clearly that it's worthwhile getting the booster with the flu shot as soon as it is available. And it is available. The CDC has approved it for anyone over the age of 6 months of age. Now, a lot of folks are thinking, well, I had COVID, or I got the previous vaccine and boosters. Let me be right up front with you. That doesn't help, because that immunity wears off. It may have some underlying help, but not to be the most effective. And what we really want to do is cut down the number of hospitalizations. That's what we're shooting for here. So people may still get sick if they got the vaccine. But by the same token, did we keep them out of the hospital? Did we keep their illness to just feeling like they had a head cold for a few days and isolating themselves? Because remember, this is still highly contagious and respiratory borne. So again, this is the goal we're shooting for. Hospitalizations were up 18% in the past week. So we know that it's spreading, and we know that people are becoming more seriously ill from the problem. So we're going to stay on top of that. I know that some people are reading, in the state of Florida, they have a surgeon general who has a very limited belief in COVID and in what to do to prevent COVID. And he's become somewhat of a political figure. Let's just back up. The reason people don't want to get the vaccine is they have questions of safety and effectiveness. There's no question that it's been effective, because since we have a vaccine available, our numbers dropped. Remember all those deaths? Remember all those people, all those bodies we were putting in trailers? We don't see that anymore. Why? Because we have an effective vaccine. Now, the safety of the vaccine. The one thing people have attacked has been you can develop a heart problem, what's called a cardiomyopathy, or an infection in your heart. Now, in the studies we've looked at, the risk of developing a cardiomyopathy, a viral infection in the heart, are infinitely more likely. It's infinitely more likely if you get COVID. That's what COVID does. So in the few isolated cases where people may have had a reaction to the vaccine, it's still disproportionate to what we see from people becoming ill. So the message is, get the COVID booster. Now, here's the caveat for today. Call the pharmacy first. So I have an appointment for Monday to go to my local pharmacy. I did this online and made my appointment for the flu vaccine and the COVID vaccine. And I could see a lot of people are signing up. There are very limited appointments already. But I called the pharmacy and spoke to the pharmacist today, who told me they don't have the vaccine yet. They're hoping they get it by Monday. So, unfortunately, a lot of people have appointments and think that the vaccine is there. So I'm sure it'll be there any day now, but call first. Call your local pharmacy. That we can move forward, and you'll have the vaccine available when it's time to get vaccinated. And it is important that we get both vaccines at the same time, get one in each arm. It may hurt for a day, but get it done. The other thing that's come up in the past week has been the use of phenylephrine. Phenylephrine was a cold medication. It was in a lot of over-the-counter cold medications, and it was the key ingredient in many of these. But recent studies have shown that it's not effective. So what you really have to know is the more effective medication in cold medicines is pseudoephedrine. I have always found that that is somewhat of a risk as well. So it'll clear your sinuses, but it can cause tachycardia. We have seen it cause seizures, and that's why it's in limited supply. Also, pseudoephedrine, as well as methamphetamine, okay? So if you take methamphetamine as well as pseudoephedrine, you can make crystal meth. And that's why these things are only sold behind the counter. So people will say, you're not going to see Sudafed and pseudoephedrine out there on the aisles. So with that, please bear that in mind when you're looking for cold medicine. I'm sure it's always worth just going to the back of the pharmacy and asking the pharmacist the question about what is most effective. So we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Saeed Ahmed. Dr. Ahmed is board certified in adult psychiatry and addiction psychiatry. And I have a lot of questions. I'm sure people will, from the standpoint that really what is the most effective way of attacking this problem? And what are some of the innovative things that he brings to St. Francis Hospital for our patients locally? You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WCIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And today we are discussing addiction medicine. And as always, I am bringing on an expert in the field, Dr. Saeed Ahmed. Dr. Ahmed is the Director of Addiction Services. He's triple board certified in general or adult psychiatry, and addiction medicine. And he recently comes to us here in Connecticut from Vermont. Dr. Ahmed, welcome.
Oh, hi, Dr. Alessi. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you, but let's get started because there's so much to really go over here, and I think that people don't understand. So, first of all, can you describe the background to what addiction medicine is and maybe even touch on opioid use disorder?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's a great question. This is how I would start with someone who want to know about what the addiction is. So the way we define it is obvious. It's a chronic disease. It's a relapsing disorder often characterized by drug-seeking behavior and use, which could be compulsive, extraordinarily compulsive, and really difficult to control. Despite of harmful consequences, the consequences could be social, consequences could be mental and physical. Now, unlike in the past, but now we have in modern era, we understood that this is considered as a brain disorder, brain disease, because the way a drug changes the brain structure, the brain, how it works, the dysfunction of that structure actually leads to some physiological, social, and spiritual manifestation. So addiction has evolved. The definition itself has evolved over the course of years, but now we understand this is just like any other disease, like heart disease, like lung disease. So this is how we are defining. And about the opiate is part B of your question, how we got here with this whole opiate crisis. Last year, we witnessed a year before 107,000 people died to overdoses, which was like 70 to 80% people but died to opiates, especially synthetic opiates or fentanyl. Now, opiate crisis is nothing. It's not really new to this country. The whole thing started way back in late 18th century and early 19th century. If you could remember, if you see retrospectively, historically, we had opium, morphine, and then it was later in early 19th century, heroin actually took over for some medical purposes as well as recreational. And you remember the morphine was used extensively for pain management,
sure,
especially during World War II and other wars. And now the way we describe it now, which is extremely important to understand, the way we define it, we have four distinct waves. Four. This is how we are addiction people. We identified four waves. The first wave was in early 1990s, which was a significant turning point. And you often see a lot of documentaries nowadays on Netflix and others. Pharmaceutical companies promoted opiates as a safe for chronic pain. Doctors begin prescribing them more frequently, believing that they were less addictive or actually even not addictive to begin with. But this was the first wave, we call the first wave, when people increased prescribing opiates in 1990s, and which actually led to orders of death due to prescription opiates. Now, in early 2000 to 2010, the second wave taken, what happened then, because when we started noticing that the opiates are highly addictive, the prescription become very harder to obtain. The regulations become strict. And when the regulations become strict, people actually turn to heroin and synthetic opiates, and they turn to the street because the drugs were cheaper, often more potent. This was our second wave when we got involved in heroin crisis. Now, we started with prescription, then we got into heroin. And the third wave, moving forward, 2013 and onwards, recent 10 years, we actually ended up seeing a different scenario, which is more of synthetic opiates involving manufactured fentanyl, illicitly, the way the drug cartels mixing fentanyl with heroin, counterfeit pills, even to the cocaine. Now, that's the third wave. Now, more recently, in the last 2 or 3 years, even very recently, we have witnessed fourth wave, which is very unique. The fourth wave actually is not just restricted to opiates, but what we are seeing, it has become a perfect storm. Opiates actually came along with cocaine and methamphetamine, which we saw like up to 30 to 35% people orders of death when they saw their death mortuaries. Postmortem report, they found stimulants along with the opiates. So we are actually now, it is not documented anywhere, but I'm predicting we're going to see the fifth wave. We are actually in the fifth wave. I haven't seen this terminology, fifth wave, but the xylazine, the new drug, animal tranquilizer, we are seeing across the country, Philadelphia, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Vermont. It's becoming more and more problem. Xylazine is being laced with fentanyl, which is animal tranquilizer, a highly sedative drug. Unfortunately, there's no antidote to this drug. And it's actually affect people not only to respiratory centers and at least to death, but also comes with serious consequences of wound and skin problems. So this is how we got here.
Well, first of all, that's fascinating, especially since it dates back such a long time ago, from that standpoint, and the number of drugs. Why mix a tranquilizer with the narcotic? I don't even understand why they would do that. I mean, I understand, you know, wanting to bind to opioid receptors. Is that what it does, the xylazine?
Well, xylazine, what does, it's just like a sedative, like back in the, yeah. If you remember the last 20 years, people were using benzos to potentiate, enhance the euphoric effect of opiates, narcotics. Same thing they are doing. I have assessed several patients, and it's a hands-on experience. When you talk to the patient, you ask them, like, okay, why would you use xylazine when you had fentanyl in your hand or access? So they would tell you it potentiates the effect of fentanyl and it prolonged the euphoric effect. So I don't know how it works, but I mean, at molecular level, but it does potential practically when they use it. And unfortunately, I don't have a perfect answer. Why would drug cartels start?
Yeah. No, I think you've explained it to me. So it does potentiate the use of it. Let me just go back a little bit. So when we talk about addiction medicine, it's not just opioids. So, I mean, you're dealing with people who have other addictions like cocaine or methamphetamine and things such as that as well, I assume.
Right.
Okay.
And yeah,
Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, sorry.
No, and that's a board certification now for physicians.
So we are seeing all the. I mean, we are. You're right. So when we work in a practical setting in a hospital, we often see other drugs too. You're right. We saw benzos perfect a storm in the last 20 years. But I think the regulations have been strict. The prescription monitoring system has actually curbed this crisis to a certain extent. And stimulants. The problem, I think, what happened recently is it's more of like when the drug on war and everything came, and then from 70s up to until this year, 50 years. So the whole thing started with like curtailing drugs from influx in this country. At one point, when you curtail drugs from outside, the people, the local domestic manufacturers started cooking some other stuff because they still have to provide supplies to the people. Sure. I think the stimulant crisis came into from that situation when obviously we were not able to curtail the entire crisis of opioids, but what happened in Midwest and other small rural actually, especially areas where people started cooking methamphetamine in their house and basement, and this is how people actually gives some kind of an alternative channel.
Sure.
To the people to create their own domestic production, and they were not open, they were not able to produce heroin because obviously there's no poppy seed here, opium.
Right.
What they did, they ended up making other drugs like methamphetamine, cocaine, because it can be manufactured locally and domestically. So this is the crisis
we're going to take a short break now because I really want to get this is the topic I really want to hit on what we're going to do about the problem and how the problem developed. So anyhow, we're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Saeed Ahmed, and we're talking about addiction medicine. You could reach us at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds of WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. My guest today is Dr. Saeed Ahmed, and we are discussing addiction medicine and his work as Director of Addiction Services at St. Francis Hospital. If you would like more information about addiction medicine or have a loved one or yourself who would like to get involved in their program, the phone number is 860-714-2470. Saeed, before the break, we started talking a little bit about the war on drugs, and it's been going on now, as you said, 50 years. Can we assume that we are losing the war on drugs?
When we say war on drugs, this is actually more of the term we use actually originated back in 70s. It became popular during Nixon administration in 1970s. Actually, this was a campaign for
sure.
Drug prohibition and military aid, military intervention to reduce illegal drug trade in the United States, naturally, internationally. The way this was structured, or obviously the objectives or intention was good. What they wanted to do, increase penalties on people who are using drugs or in possession or distribution of drugs, crack cocaine or other drugs, and also internationally they wanted to disturb drug production in other countries, not only here but South America and other countries by direct military intervention all the way in their countries. Some people actually say that we actually exported our campaigned with other countries, including Russia. So, and then the war on drug actually ended up become a big financial, burden at some point, because it increased a lot of funding, billions and billions of dollars. But what happened, answer to your question, are we really losing this? What happened, again, intention was good, but what happened, looking back, and now we ended up getting more incarceration because the way it was structured, the people who are using even cannabis, they ended up in jail time and they become incarcerated. And it also came with some other social consequences, just for example, disproportionately affected communities of minorities, especially Black and Hispanic and brown, and which actually created more of mistrust towards law enforcement from the minorities. And then also economic cost, I talked about we spend billions on billions of dollars, but we still have every year you see the numbers that overdoses, deaths are actually escalating, increasing, not going other way around. We should have a less number than the 10 years prior, but every year we are seeing, like last year I said, 107,000 people died to overdoses, which actually seems to be largely, we think that we have largely, it has been a failure because continued drug use escalating every year, social consequences, we are seeing social consequences in terms of incarcerations, economics, and then I think the emphasis, the biggest emphasis, which is a drawback, the pinpoint, if you ask me, pinpoint a single item on this campaign, which could become a bigger problem for a public health crisis, was punishment over treatment. That was actually a main theme of this campaign. But now, obviously, over the course of years, we learned the lesson that we should be approaching, we should be applying other strategies, more effective, scientifically evidence-based, harm reduction, treatment over incarceration, decriminalization, public health approaches, education. So now we have learned lesson at least.
Well, first of all, we had one crisis, and then we created another one with too many people in prison and incarcerated. So obviously it didn't work. But now let's talk about this approach of harm reduction, a relatively new term, because as you said, and we said at the outset of today's program, right, the number of deaths from overdose, 107,000 is the number for the most recent data in 1 year. The goal is to keep people alive. So can you talk a little bit about harm reduction and what's being done with this strategy?
Well, harm reduction is not a new idea. It's the way it became more popular now in the last 2-3 days, obviously, since we saw the escalating number of opiate overdoses, opiate-related overdoses. That's, first of all, there's no universal definition of harm reduction. There is no formula or model that we say, this is it, this is what we should be applying, or everybody should adopt it and start working on this. So usually the way it works is a concept, it's an idea, it's a thought process. Like, it is designed to serve the people who actually use drugs, and it is individualized treatment. It's more based on individualized and community needs. And the biggest piece of harm reduction is that you reach out to the people, you treat them where they are, not like the old school, like abstinence model, which was like, you have to abstain drug, otherwise yes or no, one way or other. That was brutal, punitive. And the harm reduction approach is more of like minimizing the negative impact of drug use on the individuals or communities, while acknowledging, while we know they are still using drugs, but we have to decrease the consequences of their use. Could be physical, could be mental, could be socioeconomical, or at many levels. So that's the goal of harm reduction. Now, how do we approach this approach model of harm reduction in the context of opiate crisis? obviously, opiate crisis, more of related to opiate overdoses. So, for example, you must have heard, our audience must have heard about naloxone, Narcan distribution. It's there's several movements across this country, every state, every county, every small town, Narcan distribution. This is a piece of harm reduction. Training and education about opiate overdoses and use of Narcan itself in the families, communities, recognizing the most important, recognizing symptoms of overdoses, somebody's respiratory rate is going down or they're shallow breathing, like go ahead and give them Narcan. Then other approaches like needle or needle syringe exchange programs, like because you know when people use intravenous drugs, they end up sharing needles and they end up getting HIV, Hep C, hepatitis B. So that's another piece that these programs or harm reduction strategies provide sterile needles and syringes for drug users to reduce those consequences. Then the biggest piece of this harm reduction approach in the context of opiate crisis is MAT, Medication Assisted Treatment Program. That is critical. I would say it's the backbone of this harm reduction model, that using medications like methadone, buprenorphine, aka Suboxone, commonly known as Suboxone, or naltrexone, along with counseling and therapies. So MAT is also itself is a part of harm reduction. It's not something that harm reduction is only rely on needles or Narcan. I've been talking to people, and the folks think that harm reduction is only restricted or limited to Narcan distribution, needle syringe, educational program, or just sharing flyers. No, MAT itself is a harm reduction strategy, and that is actually a backbone of harm reduction strategy. And obviously, harm reduction just not limited to those, but harm reduction goes above and beyond. You talk about decriminalization of personal use. Somebody is using for cannabis for personal use, but you don't want to send these people to jail for 6 years or seven years. And harm reduction also include access to healthcare. That's a bigger piece, access, because so imagine we have 2.7 to 3 million people diagnosed cases of OUD, opiate use disorder, although we have millions of others who are abusing opiates, prescription opiates. But if we go by only by diagnoses, you can imagine like more than half of the people even have no access to treatment, OUD for opiate addiction. So access to treatment itself is also part of harm reduction. And then support groups, peer groups. So those are the strategies, harm reduction. So old school was like, hey, you got to stop doing drugs. You know, if you don't do it, you're not going to come to treatment. And they often getting dropped out or kicked out of program. But now that the concept has changed, while they're still using it, you can still welcome them to be in a program, and you continue working with them where they are at, and they eventually they're going to turn around, they're going to stop using it.
All right. I had a question here. Bob sent over a question. It's a question I had too. Can you talk a little bit about the strategy of using methadone versus Suboxone? Because now we're seeing a lot of Suboxone centers, I guess, but as opposed to previously, we had methadone centers, right, where people got the regular dose of methadone. But I know of several physicians, not just people who are certified in addiction medicine, they have gone into setting up Suboxone clinics. Can you tell me the difference between the two drugs and the approaches to treatment?
Yeah, excellent question. I really appreciate you asking this question, because I often hear this question even from patients like, hey, if someone is in the clinic, like, hey, do I need to go with Suboxone or versus methadone? So first and foremost, we need to understand that these two are equally highly effective treatment for opioid use disorder, opioid addiction, okay? There's no data or science which suggests or indicate that one is better than other. So there is no evidence as of today. So both are, there are some pros and cons of one medication or other. just like any other medications in other fields. So highly effective, very effective. Obviously, there are, you know, when you talk about any treatment, you always talk about outcomes, right? What outcomes are you going to see? Like, what is going to be prognostically improved? So we have seen it, these two medications equally improve survival rate, maintain recovery and sobriety, decrease drug use, help people to get the jobs. And people sometimes they get surprised, like how the methadone is going to help them a job. Because if they stay sober, they have a stable life, they're going to do jobs. And it really, you're going to be surprised that there's a published data which indicate that these two drugs reduce not only relapses or infectious diseases, but also crime rate and incarceration. Because indirectly, if someone in the treatment, they're not going to do shoplifting, they're not going to get into criminal activities. So they stay sober, they stabilize their lives. So both are effective. Now, what's the difference between two? Methadone is a little bit older than old medication than Suboxone. Methadone is often used for severe opioid addiction, like somebody using like 100 bags of heroin. There's no heroin anymore, unfortunately. It's all fentanyl. It's more often preferable for people who have multiple relapses, frequent relapses, and they have difficulty to maintain sobriety. So methadone is sometimes clinically in practical setting is prioritized in those patients. Now, one thing about methadone we all need to know, that methadone, if methadone is being misused, it can lead to overdose and eventually it's going to cause death. Especially when someone mixes methadone with other substances like benzos or stimulant. Now, one other thing about methadone, Suboxone, methadone medication is only dispensed through, we usually used to call methadone clinic, but it's an opiate treatment program, also known as OTP's clinic. While Suboxone, something which is extraordinarily good about Suboxone, there's a less likely chances. When I'm saying less likely, there are slight chances, like minor, like fractional, but overall, Suboxone is much safer. You may not be able to overdose on this medication. And there's a highly reduced risk of overdose on buprenorphine if you're in the treatment. Now, good news about Suboxone, that it can be prescribed from any clinic. Any clinic means doctor's office, you can go to any primary care, you can go to psychiatrist, you can go to addiction medicine doctor, so they can prescribe you Suboxone. But while methadone, you cannot get methadone from any clinic. It has to be by federally regulated clinics, which are commonly known as methadone clinics. Now, we can talk about like what are the pros and cons about going to methadone clinic versus going to the doctor's clinic. So it depends on the patient's priorities and preferences and logistics. Most importantly, logistics. I ran a methadone clinic for 3 years. I was the medical director in Vermont. So Vermont is a country, it's a rural area. Some people have difficulty to go to methadone clinic every day to get the methadone dose because it's required for patients to be who are receiving methadone to come to clinic every day for first 90 days. Now, a lot of people do not have transportation, especially who are living a life with drug addiction, had 2 DUI or DWIs in their record. They cannot drive. They don't have transportation. They are living far from methadone clinic. If they are living 35 miles from methadone clinic, it's so difficult for them to get up in the morning and get to the methadone clinic. And methadone clinics usually dose people from 6 to 10 historically. So they you have to be there, this window, small window, to get the methadone. It could be difficult for so many patients, so they actually prefer to go with Suboxone. Suboxone, you don't have to go to a methadone clinic. You can go get this drug from You have neighborhood clinic, like any medical doctor. So that's the big difference. Otherwise, effectively, from effective perspective, both are effective. Both really work well.
Well, let me just touch on something you touched on. Yeah, geographically, and we only have a couple of minutes left, but I really want to get on this. Geographically, you know, a lot of times we always think of drug addiction being a problem in big cities. Yet you were in Vermont. We're in more of a suburban area. Do you see it more in big cities, or is it a problem everywhere?
It's a good question. Drug actually distribution varies from area to area. It's urban areas have different drugs, and country areas, rural areas have different drugs. You would be surprised that some rural areas are more into stimulant because they are locally made drugs.
Crystal
and
meth.
Some urban area, they cook methamphetamine locally, which is pure and cheaper because it's domestically made. While compared versus someone is in urban areas, Hartford downtown or maybe Boston downtown or, you know, bigger cities, we are seeing a lot of opiates because I think access to drug itself is a different, this is a whole separate topic, but it varies. I have seen in rural areas, people use, they drink a lot more than urban areas. I have seen, I mean, it's my experience. It's not something that I'm telling you from any published data.
No, that's okay. I want your experience.
Because rural areas that people have, because, you know, it's a social norm. It's easily accessible, let's put it this way. Like liquor store in any neighborhood, you can go and get the liquor. So that's easy accessible. So they have access to only one drug, let's call it alcohol. So they are more dependent on that drug, because they have access to only that drug for that period of time when they are there in that part of the world. While in urban areas, we see different designer drugs. You might be surprised. We see like Crocodile, we see like Xylazine, we are seeing like these drugs like obviously fentanyl, and we often see fentanyl analogs, like different analogs. You'd be surprised. We have seen people using like more powerful analogs of fentanyl. Fentanyl itself is just one analog. We often see more powerful. We hardly see in rural areas because these drugs don't even go there. So it varies. It really varies from coast to coast. Midwest, you see a lot of stimulant. West Coast, you see a lot of stimulant. You hardly, New England, especially we five states, we see a lot of opiates here. Compared to someone who's using in Western New York is way different than here. It's way different in Midwest. So it's geographically, for example, I haven't seen someone using Spice or K2 like synthetic cannabis in Hartford, but I have seen synthetic cannabis very highly prevalent in Long Island, New York. So it's different. So it's geographically drugs varies. So this is interesting. I mean, you would be amazed by, you know, drug distribution based on economic people's buying capacity,
sure,
or based on race, or especially race too. Some races and actually other factors like LGBTQ population have more preferable drugs than other people, than the heterosexual and female gender has different drugs. Yeah. And even kids' age also varies. Young adults or kids are using more of vaping and inhalants, like you'd be surprised, they're using like glue or other stuff. The adult age,
sure,
older patient population use more alcohol and benzos. So everything matters.
Saeed, I want to thank you. We're running out of time, and I'll have to get you back on because we want to talk about future strategies. But I want to thank you for your time, and thank you for your expertise over at St. Francis Hospital. And if you wish to get involved in the program at St. Francis Hospital, the number is 860-714-2470. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. With that, we're going to wrap things up right now. I want to thank Kevin Corza, who's been on the board for today. And actually, and always want to thank Jeff Chandler in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. I may see some of you later at 3:30. We have kickoff at UConn. I will be on the sideline as always. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.